Hello all, and welcome to the first teleclass of 2010. My name is Paul Weber, and today's teleclass is The Role of Environmental Surfaces in Healthcare Infections. On behalf of my colleague and the co-founder of Teleclass Education, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to thank you for joining us. Dr. Philip Carling is the Director of Infectious Diseases and Epidemiology at Kearney Hospital in Boston and a professor at Boston University School of Medicine. This man first came to very wide attention in 2006 after he published scientific articles on the use of a novel technology to evaluate cleaning in hospitals. Since then, he has produced several other articles on environmental hygiene, and his work has shown up in a great many other places, including, I should add, quite a few of our teleclass lectures. I have been present for two lectures that he gave at conferences and was so impressed, it is with great anticipation that I welcome him today. Before I turn things over to Dr. Carling, I would also like to acknowledge the sponsor of today's teleclass, Ecolab. I've been very impressed with these guys, and they are extremely supportive of infection control education as well as this teleclass program. Thank you very much to everyone at Ecolab. So now from the Boston University School of Medicine to present The Role of Environmental Surfaces in Healthcare Infections, I am delighted to present Dr. Philip Carling. Dr. Carling.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Paul. That was a very nice introduction. What we're going to be talking about today is a subject which some people still feel is of relatively small relevance in the world of hospital-associated infections, but I believe some of what I hope to show you today, as well as maybe your own knowledge of where the literature has been, might help emphasize the fact that we're getting a clear understanding about this over the past couple of years, and that there certainly is a role for environmental transmission. Quantifying it is still an art that's evolving, but what I'd like to do today is sort of give you some of the background and talk about what we've done and some of the work that we've been doing to improve environmental hygiene in healthcare settings, and to give you sort of an overview of those issues. Slide number 3 outlines basically our little talk today, current issues in isolation and hand hygiene. I want to just go back over a few things in this very important area because it puts the environment, I think, in a little more context. Why it's important, we'll talk about, and then what to do about the problem of contamination. How can we do better with this, and what are some of the things we're thinking about to do better with it, and then the whole issue, finally, of course, of outcome. Can improving environmental hygiene impact the transmission of healthcare-associated pathogens? The next slide shows a very simple paradigm that I think describes where we are with this business. It's not complicated. It's basically trying to keep the bad bugs, the resistant organisms that are in patients or on their skin, from getting too susceptible patients. To prevent this, in the next slide, you can see the healthcare workers' hands have been recognized for at least the past 20 years and more vigorously for the past 10 years as being a sort of a centerpiece of this issue. And, of course, what we can do to decrease contamination of healthcare workers' hands and transmission to patients has two components. The first is, on the next slide, isolation. Isolation is traditional activity, has not changed very much in its parameters since the 1950s, but it does have some issues. As mentioned on slide number 7, all of you listening, I'm sure, very much appreciate that it's really difficult to implement and maintain a good isolation practice. It's cumbersome, it's hard on patients, and basically, most importantly, I think, it's that we don't really know when to begin and when to stop. We have been recommending, for example, for the past 25 years or so, that C. diff contact precautions be used when a patient had diarrhea and be discontinued when the diarrhea was under control. But recent work, and in fact from a couple of sources, but most vividly from Dr. Donsky's group in Cleveland, just published this month actually in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology, very vividly showed how long patients contaminate their environment, even when they're asymptomatic and not having diarrhea anymore and have been treated for C. diff, because it stays colonizing the GI tract and continues to spread, and has moved a lot of folks, this kind of data, towards increasing the duration of isolation when a patient is identified as having C. diff to at least the duration of their hospitalization. there has been a lot of discussion over the past decade about extreme isolation, the search and destroy approach to MRSA, which was implemented in many Northern European countries just as MRSA started to become recognized in healthcare settings as being a transmission problem. That is about in the late 1970s. Because of concerns by folks in those countries about MRSA transmission, they started this concept of surveillance cultures and then isolation of patients who were infected or colonized. This initiative, I think all of you are probably aware, was very effective when it was done in that setting, in a pre-endemic setting, which is very different from the world we live in today in most countries. But also a problem with this this approach that hasn't been talked about too widely is the fact that the endemic nosocomial infection rates in those countries that have very low MRSA rates is not particularly different from the nosocomial infection rates in countries where we have a lot of MRSA, relatively speaking. And so they've sort of focused in one area and not been able to necessarily carry that same type of focus into another area. It's not to say it wasn't worthwhile, but it was, I think, something that had a very good role in the places that it was done and for the reasons it was done, but I'm not so sure that it's widely applicable in the rest of the world at the present time. There's a lot of controversy still about whether active surveillance cultures should be used. In the U.S. here, as many of you probably know, there have been large hospital groups that have decided to do active surveillance cultures for all patients being admitted to check them for VRE and MRSA and to isolate all colonized patients. The success of that impact on infections has been debated within that system. Some hospitals believe they've seen a favorable impact. Others believe there's been no impact. Other groups have looked very carefully at MRSA issues and found that they were able to decrease their MRSA infections and transmission just by doing better practice of traditional approaches rather than do any active surveillance. It's an area that is still being debated. I think I could summarize it best, at least from my possibly biased viewpoint, by saying that if you have a problem with MRSA transmission, maybe active surveillance should be considered, particularly if it's in an intensive care unit situation where you're seeing transmission. If you don't necessarily have this problem in terms of evidence of transmission, the benefits might not be so much from the amount of work relative to the amount of work involved. The issues I mentioned down the bottom of the slide there, unfortunately, it's there are other issues about just looking at the epidemiology of MRSA, is that there are studies that have only looked at nasal colonization, and I think there's good enough evidence now that we can talk about it widely that GI tract colonization is important in MRSA, and transmission to the environment from the GI tract, of course, is not too difficult in hospitalized patients. The next two slides will give you two very, very fine papers that anybody who wants to think more about the pros and cons of isolation problems ought to take a look at. The second paper in particular by Dr. Kirtland from Dartmouth, I think to me was most helpful, pointing out some conceptual approaches to how to think more, let's say, effectively about contact isolation. I urge everybody to take a look at this paper. It's not a strict guideline, but it does say, here's what we don't know about isolation, namely that it works at all, and here's the downsides, and here's what we ought to think about when we're trying to decide who does and does not warrant isolation. So I'd call that the state-of-the-art paper in terms of thinking about isolation issues. Going on to hand hygiene, there are issues with hand hygiene as well. We're not here to suggest that hand hygiene is not important. We're not here to say that it shouldn't be optimized, but that there are some very significant problems with thinking that hand hygiene might be the total solution to the problems we're facing. Success stories were based on really mixed interventions. If you look back at the studies that have been quoted for many, many years as being the studies that show that hand hygiene decreased transmission of hospital-associated pathogens, those studies were all multi-interventional studies. Other things were done. Environmental hygiene was improved. Antibiotic management was improved. Hand hygiene was objectively improved and was thought to be the most important reason for decreased transmission, but they certainly were not real studies that could be relied upon totally in terms of the conclusions I think some of them were led to, were associated with anyway. I think to me, though, the most important thing is not to look backwards, but just to think about the logistical limitations of hand hygiene. I think these are really becoming very clarified. The next slide shows a typical intensive care unit, and we know how complex and difficult it is to care for patients in these environments. Dr. Pite, some studies a while back using the WHO guideline, which I think is a very good, clear, and logical way of approaching hand hygiene issues, noted that, you know, for a patient who's sick in an ICU, there are 30 to 40 hand hygiene moments per hour of direct patient care. If folks were that busy and following WHO guidelines on the next slide, you'd basically taking 20 to 30 seconds to do proper alcohol-based hand rub, to say nothing of taking off a glove and putting it back on again. You see that it's a challenge to be able to do as much hand hygiene when you're taking care of sick patients as maybe would be ideal. It's also, on the next slide, a nice study from Journal of Hospital Infections this year showed how compliance deteriorates rather rapidly during a single patient encounter in terms of hand hygiene. That is, the opportunities where hand hygiene should be used, if you only have a brief contact with the patient is one thing, but if you're there taking care of the patient, the ability to comply with guidelines deteriorates pretty quickly. Next slide. There may be a compliance ceiling. Some very interesting modeling has raised the question whether you're going to get much more decrease in transmission of pathogens with really higher levels of hand hygiene. I think this is an area that is interesting to study, and hopefully more science will come around it as time goes on, but it's just an area to keep an eye on, I would say. Also, I think everybody is probably aware that hand hygiene improvement doesn't really decrease C. diff, being one of our major pathogens, and certainly very important, the environment certainly very important in its transmission. The reason for this, of course, everybody knows that alcohol is not effective in killing C. diff spores, but it also turns out that other things are not so easy, and that even the soap and water approaches that we've been advocating for years in patients with C. diff are not as effective as we thought. Some very nice work by Dr. Dale Girding that was presented this spring at the epidemiology meetings clearly shows that C. diff doesn't move off your hands, even doing ideal hand hygiene as well as we'd like to think it did. He believes that there's some evidence that C. diff is particularly adherent to skin surface compared to other spores that have been used to sort of test the hypothesis of this issue. Again, think about that. I think it moves me towards more glove use, which again also has its has problems. So what about this whole issue of these two interventions with their limitations? Well, it sort of brings us to the rest of the story, and that is what I call the missing link on slide number 18. Environmental surfaces certainly can move healthcare-associated pathogens back to healthcare workers' hands. Many elegant studies, VRE, MRSA, and a little bit on C. diff have shown that, and also to susceptible patients. How much of a problem is the environment? Let me just point out some recent clarification about that. Slide 21 is a summary slide that I developed in an article that was published a couple of years ago in American Journal of Infection Control that summarized what I could find in the literature that went to about 2003. And that basically shows the distribution. These are cultures, culture-positive sites in patient rooms that were on isolation for those pathogens. My take-home on this one is I'd say about 30 to 40% of surfaces in such rooms are able to show the same organisms the patient's being isolated for. A very fine study from Johns Hopkins by Dr. Speck and the other folks with Dr. Pearl there was presented in 2007. I have not yet seen it published. I hope to soon, because besides showing very similar findings as we just mentioned before, the slide number 23 shows a rather disturbing thing that these researchers noted, and that was 39% of positive cultures from staff-only touched objects were different from those from which the patient was being isolated. So we think we're isolating a patient for C. diff, and yet their environment can frequently have MRSA or VRE in it, which obviously implicates either that, probably both, that the definition of what the patient that was on isolation had in terms of a transmissible pathogen was incomplete, or that the environmental hygiene from previous patients maybe was not as complete as would be ideal. Moving on, it is possible, even if the environment gets contaminated, as Dr. Hardy showed several years ago, to clear the environment using hydrogen peroxide vapor, but the limitations, of course, understandably, are that the environment will get quickly recontaminated and transmission to patients again happen. So the approach of taking, let's say, a vigorous cleaning attack using hydrogen peroxide, let's say, or the newly discussed ultraviolet machines that can decrease pathogens in the surfaces of hospital environments that there are no patients in, may have a role in outbreak management, but in terms of daily cleaning, as you could see, you'd have to do it all the time, basically, that way, to make an ongoing effect. This interesting paper, published last year in Journal of Hospital Infections, is the first one I've seen that quantifies the amount of C. diff that's around. Patient hands had close to 6,000 PCR colony counts. The absolute number is not so relevant because, of course, it doesn't maybe tell, maybe it overestimates the amount of C. diff a little bit on somebody's hands by if it's fragmented or dead C. diff, let's say. But it's relatively consistent, in other words, in terms of the way it was managed. So you can see that the near-patient surfaces, as well as the ones further from the patient, were contaminated about half as much as the patient's hands in somebody with active C. diff, which is, I think, quite vivid. Healthcare workers' hands caring for those patients were, again, about half of the as contaminated as surfaces were. So an interesting reflection on the amount of C. diff and how it really can get around in a substantial way. Dr. Donsky's paper, 2007, Clinical Infectious Disease, I think is fairly self-explanatory. Moving on to slide 27, I think it's important to keep in mind there's been clear evidence of transmission for the organisms listed. I think most everybody would agree that C. diff is the major environmental pathogen when it's there. Its infective dose is very low, and basically the studies that show the environment's important have been really substantial over the past 20 years. The other organisms I would call important, and we don't know how to quantify this completely, are, of course, MRSA, VRE, and most recently, Acinetobacter. Although it's interesting, some studies with Acinetobacter have showed very variable rates of environmental contamination. Some have been very high rates of environmental contamination. Others have been low rates of environmental contamination where in intensive care units where outbreaks are ongoing. So as with most things in the epidemiology of these organisms, it's probably not as simple as we'd like to think it was. But the environment certainly has been suggested to have a significant role in Acinetobacter transmission. Norovirus, we know, is a very important environmental pathogen. Coag-negative staph is probably more important than we appreciate. Adenovirus, the major mode of transmission, is not through the air, but by contact of surfaces and fomites. And even influenza A, although there is still some debate about the role of airborne transmission, true airborne transmission, certainly the surfaces and surface contamination have had a role in the studies that looked at this carefully. Also, I should probably move hepatitis C and SARS up into the other list because, although not as well studied in terms of the literature, there's certainly good evidence to support hepatitis C, which we now know lives for weeks in the environment on surfaces, and it's maybe a part of the explanation why so many patients with hepatitis C don't have a clear epidemiologic source for their likely hepatitis C infection. Why are these things important? Well, on slide 29, I think, again, everybody that probably is interested in listening to this talk today knows that this is the reason. That is that these organisms survive amazingly well in the environment. I've revised this slide a few times over the past couple of years, and each time I revise it, I add more time to in one organism or another. I haven't ever decreased the amount. It seems to be the more you look, the more these things survive. It doesn't mean, by the way, that they survive at the same concentration they were inoculated onto a surface. They do, most of them, with the exception probably of C. diff, although not as well quantified, because it's so hard to do good, accurate culturing for a variety of reasons of quantifiable cultures from surfaces for C. diff spores, that basically there is a fall off in the number of organisms over time. So it's true that there may be a couple of log decrease over, let's say, a month or 2 months in MRSA in the surface, but it's still the same pulse field gel electrophoresis strains can be found, as Dr. Dancer has shown in some of her studies, that can be in the environment months after a patient has been discharged and can infect other patients. We also know on slide 30 that a number of very well-done studies over the past few years, since about 2006, have shown that patients who occupy rooms previously occupied by individuals on isolation or with active infection from these organisms have an increased risk of acquiring those organisms. This has been most vividly and clearly shown for MRSA and VRE. Acinetobacter, the major study that looked at this and showed it, was a correlation. It wasn't as direct numbers to the risk of increase. It was not able to be exactly determined. But recent clarification has been now given to us about C. diff, at least in one well-done study, which was presented at IDSA in 2008 by Shaughnessy and their group. The next slide, number 31, shows basically that the risk of acquiring C. diff, and this is a well-controlled study for other variables, was basically 110% greater than it would have been otherwise if the patient was in a room previously occupied by a patient with diagnosed as C. diff. So it basically doubled the risk. What about gloves? I mean, I mentioned gloves before. We all know that gloves have great potential for keeping environmental pathogens from going from patients onto our hands or from the environment onto our hands, particularly if we properly do hand hygiene after taking the gloves off. But the whole issue of the fact that gloves unfortunately don't decrease transmission around a unit, I think, was most vividly illustrated by this study, again from Journal of Hospital Infections this past year, that talked about an ICU with an ongoing outbreak with Acinetobacter over 4 years. 50% of the patients were infected and colonized. They all had the same strain. They kept working. They were concerned about environmental contamination. They kept working to make it better, and then subsequently did studies and saw 40% of environmental samples were positive. Again, not all studies have seen this, but when these folks looked at gloves, about two-thirds were contaminated, and the problem would be ongoing, and they were still not able to overcome it, even with this data, and trying to improve environmental hygiene more. Acinetobacter, once it gets into a hospital, particularly an ICU setting, I should say, has been very, very difficult to eliminate. So in the context of all this and these issues, I raised the question, and I like this slide, I put this in, because I think that Dr. Pité and the World Health Organization's concept of the patient zone is one that certainly makes it easier to teach a good hand hygiene practice. That's been very clearly shown. But I think it also is an area that we can use to piggyback on when thinking about environmental hygiene, because the most critical areas of environmental hygiene are most probably the ones that are also in the patient zone. In thinking about this whole issue, what can we do? We can develop better disinfectants. We can develop more effective ways to clean. We can improve thoroughness of cleaning. So as I thought about this, the next slide, number 35, shows me thinking about this. This whole issue of disinfectants, I think, needs to be reconsidered. We certainly know that there's a big difference of opinion between many folks in the U.S. and many in Canada and the folks in the EU regarding the value of routine use of disinfectants. We don't have time to go into that debate right now, but I have to tell you that, in my opinion anyway, the studies that we really need to have done to define these issues and the importance of these issues have not been done yet. They certainly are sorely in need of being done. Do we need a better bleach or a greener bleach? Of course we need a greener bleach, but will something that's green work for C. diff spores? Not yet that we've seen. Can it be rapidly effective? I mean, there's been a lot of interest in trying to get things, disinfectants that are less toxic. And from what I've seen in terms of research that's out there, we are certainly moving in that direction fairly rapidly. And I think hospitals will have safer, more effective, greener, if you will, with less residual disinfectants available to them within the next, just a couple of years, the next 1 or 2 years, that will help change this equation. But in terms of their effectiveness, I've yet to see really as good studies as I'd like to see to help define that better against, let's say, a standard like bleach. What about developing a more effective way to clean? Microfiber is really nice to use. It certainly is extremely effective at picking up dust, and it's also extremely effective at picking up microorganisms. But is there differences between microfiber? The answer is probably yes. Can you understand those differences by looking at labeling? The answer is probably not, because it's not easily defined, and there's always potential for bias when you're looking at descriptions of how things work. So studies really need to be done. They haven't been well done. Disposable wipes are also something that's certainly widely used. How effective they are, it looks like they are moderately effective, but they mostly depends upon if they're wet. I've seen wipes in the hospitals that have been sitting out open in a container top, and they're really not wet at all anymore. And would those going to work well to clean a surface? I don't think so. Again, I haven't yet seen the quantitative studies to document that, but it certainly sounds like it could be a problem with the way wipes are used sometimes. Differences between wipes, you know, do we need to have a bleach-containing wipe, or is it the mechanical issue of the wipe? Still not able to answer these things the way I'd like to for you. Stay tuned, that's all I can say. Keep watching and keep encouraging people to do the good studies before you invest in the new technologies. So when I started considering these issues, I realized quickly I couldn't do anything about the first two, so I sort of fell into the issue of thinking about how well the environment was being cleaned or not well cleaned. And I didn't have money to do much in the way of environmental culturing. In fact, I didn't have any money to do environmental culturing. And so I had to try to figure out a way to do a surrogate, make a surrogate for culturing. And that's how we came up with the solution that's described on targeting solution slide. We needed a solution that dries rapidly, that was environmentally stable. And it took a while to try to figure out how to do that. It wasn't easy to develop. It's basically a mixture of detergents, several different kinds of glue, and a clear fluorescent marker that after the target dries allows it to be fluoresced to see where it is. Slide 42 shows what it looks like on the target. You can see it there if you look carefully. It isn't too hard to spot if you really look for it. It's been modified recently to be much less visible than this. This is the older version of the solution, but both versions do fluoresce very brightly. What we started doing our initial studies on slide 44, we looked to try to consider how well discharge cleaning was being done. Our first studies only looked at terminal room cleaning, or discharge cleaning as it's known, because it was a defined entity. The policies and procedures were similar in most hospitals for this kind of activity, if not almost identical. And the expectation in point in time was pretty easy to define. That is, when a patient was no longer occupying that bed. Looking at the objects, we chose 14 objects in the traditional patient room to monitor for these initial studies. They were chosen on the basis of the research that I had presented a while ago that showed what was being contaminated. Those studies that showed rates of contamination also, I didn't show the slide, also showed which objects are being documented to be contaminated the most. And so we chose those as being the primary ones to look at. The only one that wasn't really studied and has yet to be really carefully studied is the grab rail besides the toilet. But we thought that it was so important that the first thing that a patient touches after toileting, maybe if they have C. diff diarrhea, for example, is going to be the grab rail there. And so we felt that was important to see how well that was being cleaned as well as the other areas noted. And this model outlined on slide number 45 is the protocol, if you will, that we've used in essentially identical manner with all the hot studies I'm going to tell you about, both related to terminal room cleaning as well as some of the other studies that are in process. It's a three-phase approach. The first phase is a covert evaluation of how environmental hygiene is being done in that area or that hospital prior to making interventions. It is sometimes challenging to do this, but because infection preventionists have been monitoring environmental hygiene for years, it was part of what they could do to just change their approach a little bit and use our marking tool to see more objectively if things are being cleaned or not being cleaned by the according to the policies that were in existence in the hospitals. Once we got adequate baseline data from a number of patient rooms, then that data was collated and shared with environmental services and with quality assurance and the infection control committee subsequently to help develop an action intervention plan appropriate to that institution. The results of the early initial studies were used to some degree in educational intervention, but actually we don't recommend focusing on pre-intervention data to present to the environmental services staff since it has some negative implications, as I'll show you in a moment. And so we really do the education, at least with the studies that we've had in the hospital group studies I'm going to show you in a minute. It's been a consistent model of education using the same sort of PowerPoint presentation, the same basic slide set, if you will, to help environmental services staff understand the importance of what they're doing, and I'll get into that a little bit in a moment. After education, then we start re-evaluating the same way it was done with the covert evaluation. We mark them before and evaluate them after they've been cleaned a couple of times and see if there's been improvement in thoroughness of cleaning. Once that's done it actually turns out now for a relatively small number of rooms, between 10 and 15 rooms, you can get a pretty accurate assessment of how things are doing, whether there's been improvement or not from baseline. And then that data is fed back specifically to the environmental services staff, so they see what they're doing. Once that kind of data shows improvement, then that is fed back more broadly to nursing staff, administrative staff, through quality assurance lines, et cetera. But it's basically a process improvement type of model with a three-phase intervention, if you will. It's described in more detail in some of the publications I'll mention in just a minute. When we first looked at three hospitals, we found that they were opportunities to improve environmental hygiene with the overall pre-intervention cleaning at about 50%, and subsequently, after education and feedback, rapidly moved up into a good bit greater thoroughness of cleaning. On the basis of that study being presented, 2005, and infection preventionists primarily, and hospital epidemiologists becoming interested in this whole issue of how is the cleaning being done in their hospital, and could it be improved if it wasn't where they wanted it to be, they came together, and I was very fortunate to garner a group of folks who were willing on a completely voluntary basis to do the legwork of evaluating this system, if you will, in their hospitals. What was found was summarized in the 36 hospital paper that is on slide number 48, and you can see the reference there from November 2008. Our pre-intervention data is shown on slide 49. Our baseline data, 36 acute care hospitals were looked at. A large number of objects were evaluated, 20,000 in that part of the study were evaluated. And the pre-intervention data in terms of how well rooms were being cleaned of those on those with respect to those 14 objects at the time of discharge is shown here, and again stayed pretty close to 50%. We're now up to about 100 hospitals that have done this exact study, and I can tell you that the curve has not shifted very much. The rather bell-shaped distribution has not changed. There are some hospitals that at baseline were pretty well cleaned, up in the range of 80%. There are a few that were really not being well cleaned, at least in terminal room cleaning, and were down the range of 20%. But as you can see, the majority fell around 50 or maybe to 55%. Now that we're up to about 100 hospitals, it's shifted a little bit to the right. But it's roughly 50% of what's supposed to be cleaned is being cleaned in at least U.S. hospitals as part of terminal room cleaning. If you look at the specific objects that we evaluated, the next slide shows that there's a rather wide distribution in how the objects are cleaned, that some things, particularly the ones that are not well cleaned, there's a rather wide distribution of individual hospital performance. What was particularly concerning to us that we noted when collating this data was that some of the objects that were the least well cleaned were some of the things that most likely were going to be able to transmit these hospital-associated pathogens to other patients, to healthcare workers' hands, and to other patients. The slide number 51 shows the result in sort of a breakdown kind of slide. This slide was not in the article for lack of space, but shows what we've continued to see, and that is that about half of the hospitals that undertake this project using our targeting solution see very rapid improvement from baseline with just essentially with education alone. They do their baseline, they say to their staff, here's where we are, here's what we got to do, and when they go back to evaluate it, they're doing really well, and they continue to do really well. That's about half the hospitals, maybe a little bit more than half with the larger group of analysis now. About a third of the hospitals here in our first study, it was about 10 hospitals, show an interesting phenomenon, and that is that they have trouble improving. They improve a little bit with education and several feedback cycles, but it doesn't improve anywhere near to the degree that it did in the first group, the thoroughness of environmental cleaning. The problem with these hospitals we found uniformly to be an administrative issue. There's some administrative hang-up that the systematic evaluation, objective evaluation of cleaning brought to light. And once that systematic problem is addressed, then the hospitals improve essentially to a level almost identical with the first group. Examples of this kind of problem are communication problems between when the patient is being discharged and when environmental services is asked to clean a room. A couple of hospitals had issues where the work distribution was not well defined as to who should be cleaning what before the room was terminally cleaned. In other words, some hospitals had policies whereby nursing had to clear any blood contaminated or, let's say, dressings or IV bags or anything like that from a room before Environmental Services was allowed to start cleaning the room, which ended up causing considerable delay and the room not being cleaned until a patient sitting out in the hall waiting to go into the bed, which obviously makes for less than ideal thoroughness. But anyway, not to belabor individual points, there are different points in different hospitals. The third group of eight hospitals in this graphic showed very little improvement. They had relatively higher baselines, and some actually were pretty good at baseline, so they didn't improve very much. But the problem here was that more persistent logistical issues were there, and those issues took longer to address, at least by the time the study was over, at least for publication, had not been addressed very substantially yet. I can tell you now, a couple of years after this data set was finalized, that about half of those eight hospitals showed improvement. And there was a breakthrough. Finally, a breakthrough happened, and they showed improvement up again, similar to the level of the other two groups. The other four hospitals are still struggling, and it's primarily because of lack of administrative understanding of the importance of environmental hygiene, both maybe some of it's on hospital administration level, some of it's on environmental services administration level, but by far the majority of environmental services leadership have been very accepting of these studies and have been very supportive of this, and in fact even enthusiastically supportive once they're able to help show what a good job their people were capable of doing. The next slide shows the summary overall pre- and post-intervention up to about 75% cleaning, 77% in this study. We've subsequently seen better levels of overall thoroughness of cleaning are even achievable. I'll show you briefly that in just a minute. The hospitals are outlined on slide number 53, the ones that have been that participated. This is at 90 hospitals. We have more to add, more stars to buff this up to date a little bit. But the bigger star in Iowa there represents a whole group of hospitals because of a translational grant by Dr. Laureen Herwell to the University of Iowa that helped us move this system into about 55 hospitals in Iowa. That's been an ongoing and very interesting and positive project there. Next slide, slide number 54, is actually a preview slide for what I'll be presenting as an oral abstract presentation at the decennial meeting in Atlanta in March. This is a group of 12 hospitals from Kaiser Permanente, the Southern California group of hospitals. And what they did, they worked as a group together and shared both the results of all their hospitals as a group, very regular basis, monthly basis, as well as what solutions started to become evident as to how to get things to move in the direction they wanted them to. Basically, a study in benchmarking and in process improvement that was taken on as a group activity, and with, I think, very impressive results. The slide actually doesn't even have the most recent data on it that we'll be presenting in Atlanta that shows continued level of performance in the range of around 90% or better for essentially all the hospitals in the group over a considerable period of time. This approach had changed the culture, let's say, of terminal room cleaning in these hospitals, and in fact, the hospitals are now anxious to go and move into other areas. In fact, the next slide, number 55, is a little outline of some of the other research projects we have ongoing, looking at the same kind of approach in different venues within the hospital. The OR Terminal Cleaning Project actually has more sites than this right now. That's looking at the thoroughness of end-of-day cleaning in the OR, which is, again, a fairly standardized set of procedures and policies as recommended by AORN as to what is supposed to be done in terms of terminal cleaning. And so we did pre-intervention and post-intervention work there. NICUs and terminal cleaning, we've looked at a number of sites of NICUs. ICU daily cleaning, this is looking at isolation rooms basically in the ICUs. Because the standard for cleaning isolation rooms was well defined by the CDC in 2006, where they said that patients on isolation will have the high-risk surfaces in their rooms cleaned at least daily. I don't know what at least might come to, but I guess they're hoping that things get cleaned daily. What we've found, I can give you a preview of what we'll be publishing in this area, and that is that there are considerable opportunities for improving environmental hygiene in intensive care units and patients on isolation, substantially related to equipment because of concerns by environmental services staff that touching equipment that's still attached to patients could be dangerous to the patient. And so we've worked ways of getting around that problem. And once the ownership and the cleaning issues were able to be clarified and safety for the patients assured, the thoroughness of cleaning has improved very substantially. Skilled nursing facilities, we moved off campus to look at long-term care facilities. We've only looked at a few so far, but we're finding very similar kinds of issues in long-term care as we've found in acute care hospitals. And also the ability to improve cleaning as well has been shown, but obviously not for too many sites so we've had a chance to study yet. Chemotherapy daily cleaning for the chemotherapy suites, a number of those, again, similar findings and similar ability to improve. One of the things we found with our off-campus sites is that the environmental companies that come in to clean aren't necessarily healthcare companies. They're cleaning companies, and nobody thinks necessarily to tell them what should be done as part of their cleaning activities. They go in and change the toilet paper rolls, make sure the bathroom is tidy, empty the trash, and leave. And unless they're told that they have to do disinfection cleaning of the, let's say, chemotherapy chairs, the recliners, which have been shown to harbor VRE, a very nice study done a few years ago, they're not doing it. But of course, like other parts of these studies, once people are shown what they're not doing, they can then learn how to do it better. The Canadian hospitals, there's been about 6 hospitals in Canada that have been working with us to evaluate how the system could work in their hospitals. I can tell you that some have had striking success, good as was shown for the 36 hospital group here in the U.S. Others have had more of a challenge that have had difficulty seeing the kind of improvement they were hoping to see. And again, administrative issues are where the challenge has been. Finally, in the last few minutes, at slide number 56, about the whole issue of is there an impact? If you improve environmental hygiene, it's all well and good to improve it, but has there been an impact? What have we seen? Well, this has only been studied for the past couple of years and only in a very limited number of studies so far. All the studies have shown similar results, at least broadly similar. The most important, or I shouldn't say the most important, but the first to be published was Dr. Mary Hayden's study with Dr. Bob Weinstein in Chicago. That's on slide 57. It's outlined. I won't take time to go into the details. I could only recommend this article at the highest level for anybody in infection prevention that hasn't maybe seen it and know it well, because besides showing some very interesting results about environmental hygiene and the ability to decrease transmission of VRE through environmental hygiene alone, the way the study was designed and the analysis of the data and the way it was done, the whole epidemiologic approach to this question is of the highest level and, again, a model for folks to be aware of. And more studies like it, we hope, will be done over time. The next slide also shows their results, but we don't have time to go into those right now. On slide 59, another very important study, I believe, from Dr. Donsky's group that looked at both VRE and C. diff in their patient rooms. What you can see on the next two slides, first for VRE, is that before cleaning, when the patients were just being discharged, there was about 40% of surfaces, such as we suggested before, were contaminated by VRE. After routine housekeeping activity, cleaning, that dropped a little bit, but not very much. But after disinfection with a research team, this is basically folks that really went in and cleaned, they were able to have no positive cultures from the same environmental objects in the 16 rooms that they studied. By the way, this study, as well as the next one, they both used bleach, so there's no issue about the effectiveness of the disinfectant, at least not grossly, because bleach is certainly very effective at killing regular vegetative bacteria, say nothing of C. diff spores, which it certainly kills moderately effectively, again, not perfectly necessarily, and it does take more time, as I think probably most of you know, for bleach to kill C. diff spores than it does for bleach to kill E. coli or MRSA. Looking at the C. diff rooms, the 9 rooms that were studied there, very similar results with about roughly around 40% of surfaces before cleaning, after routine housekeeping, then after disinfection by the research team. There was just one positive culture at that point. So Dr. Donsky's or Eckstein's and Donsky's study clearly showed, again, that environmental contamination can be decreased by increasing the thoroughness of cleaning. The next study that showed that was done at the Brigham Women's Hospital by Dr. Wang's, Susan Wang's group, and Dr. Goodman's the first author, Eric Goodman. This study was done in 10 ICUs, each one with 10 beds. That's basically the 100 beds is as big as most hospitals, or many hospitals, I should say, not necessarily most, but actually it turns out it is most, because the average size hospital, at least in the United States, when you put them all together, is under 100 beds. It's around just under 100 beds. But at any rate, the Brigham, they used the system that we used in the 36 hospital study, the targeting solution, and evaluated with environmental cultures, both the contamination of the environment issue before and after intervention, and subsequently have looked at transmission. The Brigham study showed that the thoroughness of cleaning through the same system we talked about before went from 44% to 71%, which is, again, quite similar to what we saw with the 36 hospital study. This was a daily cleaning study, if you will, and in an intensive care unit, to get up to 71% with those issues that I told you about, which were not specifically addressed by the authors. They included some direction about this, but they did not take apart all the equipment issues individually to see how they were being, as many things were being cleaned as were available. So there was an improvement in thoroughness of cleaning through feedback, and there was a decrease from 45% contamination. Again, very similar figure. That's either VRE or MRSA. Pre-intervention, 45% to 27% post-intervention, so dropped by over about a third. With this drop, they now have published an abstract that was presented with actually a lot of interest in the epidemiology meetings in San Diego this past April. Dr. Dada, who has been working with Dr. Wang, showed that during the intervention period, there was a decreased transmission of MRSA to patients, and some very significantly decreased transmission of MRSA, and a trend towards decreased transmission of VRE, which had not been fully analyzed. This paper should be appearing in publication sometime in the next few months, and we'll see how the final analysis of the data comes out. So I'd say stay tuned to watch for that. So in conclusion, I think my argument would be that it's very likely that surfaces in the patient's zone are of relevance in the transmission of healthcare-associated pathogens. It's not to say that they're the only way. It's not to say we shouldn't be careful of our ventilators, that we shouldn't be doing our bundles with our central lines, that we shouldn't be optimizing hand hygiene and isolation. It's just that this is part of the equation. I think there's very clear evidence now that this is part of the equation that really can't be totally ignored. How important it is, I don't know. But I do know some studies, I don't know in the ultimate sense, because only a few studies have been done. It's certainly the studies are very consistent that have been done so far. But overall, in the big picture, that's yet to be really answered. On the other hand, though, it's clearly something can be done about. The improvements have been rather encouraging for the hospitals that have been participating in these kinds of projects. And I think there's really no reason why we shouldn't move towards optimizing hygienic cleaning. I think there's research to be done that hopefully we're going to be able to see in the next few years as to answer these questions better. Dr. Bill Rotala has been thoughtful enough to consider, he says, that we need to further consider the importance of the product and the process, and that they have to be analyzed together, if you will, that you can't say a product is going to do this or that or the other thing without looking at the process to see how the thoroughness of cleaning is being done. So that decreasing these environmental transmission of environmental pathogens has to be looked at as a coordinated issue between product and through the performance of good hygienic practice in accordance with the best policies we have at the moment. So I think at that point we'll say thank you for your time and attention. We've covered a lot of material in a short period of time. There are many other issues we could get into, and maybe we will sometime in the future. I very much appreciate Paul Weber's inviting me to do this teleconference, and very much welcome your questions. If you could forward them to him, I'd be happy to try to work on collating them and getting answers back to everybody as quick as I possibly can. Thank you again for your time.
Dr. Carling, thank you very much. It was a tremendous presentation, and on the last slide, there is an email address where people can reach you, but for questions related to this teleclass, it would be, I think, great if they emailed them to me so I could collate them and take out the duplicates and then forward them on to you. I have a question for you. Actually, I have a whole bunch of questions, but I'm going to limit myself to one. Several times, you commented that administrative issues were a barrier to the success of the cleaning program. How does that play out?
Sure. Thank you, Paul. You'd like another seminar about this? Well, basically, there are two levels of administrative issues that are encountered from time to time, not all the time, but sometimes rather persistently. One is that the Environmental Services Administration, the leadership, the directors, and particularly the supervisors, don't really buy into the concept of being evaluated objectively. Mm. They've never been evaluated objectively. And this is a bit of a shock to their system sometimes, to somebody to come around and say, look, folks, here's where you are, and we think ought to do better. And so that hasn't, the encouragement, let's say, of the line staff to do better maybe hasn't been optimal, and that's one administrative issue area. The other administrative issue is at the higher level, and that's the hospital administrative issue, where the hospital administration, the chief medical officer, the director of nursing, don't really believe that the environment is particularly important, and maybe also that they have so many other distractions on their minds all the time that bringing something along new and different, like worrying about the environment, is just a little bit overwhelming, and they just don't want to face it. And so those are the broad way of defining those issues. They're a little bit different with every hospital that has a problem. And again, most hospitals don't have problems in these areas, actually. They're approached thoughtfully and with good education, but it can be an issue.
I would think that being able to measure the success and the outcome of environmental services would be a great boon to them, even in that they can then justify their existence and justify the increase in budget that they're looking for. Because if you can't measure something, you can't manage it. And if you can't manage it, then why bother adding funds to it, right?
Absolutely, absolutely true. And it also has been used, our data has been used in hospitals to say, here's where we are now. If we reduce staff, like maybe somebody feels they need to, we're not going to be able to maintain these levels. And there has been some issues around that. There have also been hospitals that have decided to make goals, specific goals for their environmental services personnel, and have started to attach those goals to reimbursement directly, at least for managers. Interestingly enough, the line folks, the ones that are doing the real work in all this, have been extremely accepting of this. This has been one of the most amazing shocks for me in doing this work over the last 5 or 6 years. I was very nervous, to tell you the truth, the first time I presented any data like this to environmental services line people. I thought they were going to be very angry because maybe we were saying they weren't doing a good job and they thought they were doing a good job. It turns out that, first of all, they very much appreciate being recognized, being told that they're important, and the reason they don't clean things maybe as thoroughly as the policies is that they were never taught to do it that way.
Right.
And it turns out that's why the hospitals that improved so rapidly is because as soon as you ask these folks, who are, so many of them are so conscientious, by far the vast majority, that they want to do a good job, but they've never been told what to do. And as soon as they're told what to do, and then they're given feedback that makes them see that they're doing it right, it's a very positive thing.
If the person doing the training isn't doing it right, then all the way down the line, it's not going to get done right.
Precisely, because what's happened, and the traditional thing in many hospitals is that when a new environmental service person comes after, let's say, working in a fast food job and then can get maybe a little bit more money in the hospital doing environmental cleaning, they come in their first day of work, and some manager says, okay, why don't you go up there with Harry, Harry's been here for 20 years and he'll tell you what to do. And he goes up with Harry and the person is told to do just what Harry's been doing for the past 20 years.
Harry's been doing it wrong for 20 years.
It looks that way. And there is some reason to believe that that's true a lot of places, not every place, but a lot of times.
Dr. Colling, I would like you to say a little bit more on the DASO solution that you're using.
Sure. It's basically a mixture of detergent and glue and a fluorescent marker that's clear, that doesn't have any color to it. So it comes out as a transparent material. It is licensed to Ecolab. Ecolab is producing it. They will be making it available. They have started to make it available. It will be part of a structured process. It will not be available just in bottles. It's modularized, so it could be used in one room. But if you're interested in hearing more about the availability of it, just let Ecolab know, and they can keep you posted on where that might come.
Do you find that this DASO solution better than the usual UV marker that people are using?
Oh, that's a whole subject, but that's a perfectly excellent question. We're going to be talking about that in detail in Atlanta on Saturday afternoon at a symposium with Dr. Rutala. and Dr. Susan Wang about the whole world of environmental hygiene. My piece will be to talk about all these different technologies. The UV systems, basically, just to make sure everybody is aware of what they are, have to do with a technology that was developed in the 1970s to look at cleanliness of surfaces in food processing. And I don't know who it was, but got a very smart idea to basically use an enzymatic process whereby ATP, an antibody to ATP, would release, when ATP was coupled with the antibody, would release a chemical called luciferase, which is from firefly light generation, and that they could quantify how much ATP was on a surface, which, of course, because every living thing has ATP in it, correlated with bacterial, the presence of bacteria. Unfortunately, the problem, of course, is that there's ATP in dust, there's ATP in dirt, there's ATP in dead cells and dead bacteria. So it was a process that was really designed and works to this day very well for showing how clean a surface is. So that if you get no ATP on a surface, there's probably no bacteria there that are viable, as well as no other materials that might be contaminating in a food setting. But the tricky part has been that people have tried using it in healthcare settings, and it's been a bit challenging. Certainly, there is a broad correlation. Things that have very high ATP readings are very likely to be rather dirty. Things that have very, very low readings are likely to be very clean, or at least clean. But in-between readings are very hard to interpret, and there's issues with interference. There's issues with disinfectants affecting readings. So it's a tool that can be used, but it has some challenges. It has to also be used right after an object's cleaned, within 15 minutes, otherwise there's more environmental background contamination. And also, it's a good teaching tool. It can be used well as a teaching tool, but to use it as a monitoring tool, you have to do readings before and after cleaning, and that gets into Hawthorne effect and those kinds of things, which are sort of complicated. But it has uses, particularly for teaching.
Will the proceedings of your discussions on Saturday be printed or published in any way?
They will be part of an article I've been asked to write for American Journal of Infection Control. A special supplement will be coming out sometime, we hope, this summer. They were nice enough to ask me to do some of the similar stuff that I'll be talking about in Atlanta that will be published then. Yes, thank you.
Good.
Dr. Carling, I just wanted to make a comment about the invisible marker. We tried it recently, and I of course, I wouldn't tell you the brand, but we had a very difficult time getting the marker off certain surfaces. So we saw a change in some of the surfaces. Some of it was easy to remove, and at other times it was extremely difficult. So we had a hard time actually evaluating the effectiveness of cleaning. And I just wanted to make that comment.
Well, thank you. I've talked to a lot of IPs over the past few years that have tried to use various materials. There are hand hygiene teaching products out there that can be made into a lotion. In fact, some are produced, as you might know, as a lotion. But that's been the problem, is that they don't dry, and then when they dry, they're very hard to remove. They really weren't designed for this, and that's what took me a couple of years to try to figure out, was how to get something that both stuck as well as was easily removed. So I do agree that that's a challenge, and that has been recognized. Thank you.
I wondered, in the hospitals where you're from, where you saw sustained high level of cleaning, was there the same disinfectant used in those hospitals, or was that looked at?
They're all the same. They're all using quads. Remember, what we're measuring here, what we're talking about, is thoroughness, not cleanliness. It's an important distinction, because if we could do cultures like Dr. Donsky did, or Dr. Hayden did, or the folks at the Brigham did, that would, of course, we could measure cleanliness as well as thoroughness. The reason I fell into this idea of doing it this way was mostly because I couldn't afford to do cultures. And so I had to figure out some surrogate. So it's basically a surrogate, but it doesn't, of course, show that a surface is clean. Now, there have been some studies that aren't published yet that do correlate the cleaning with the removal of the DASO target with effective cleaning of a surface. That will be appearing later this year, but it's not surprising.
Well, our speaker was very brave to put an email address on the conclusion slide. Not his email address, we should point out, but presumably an assistant, and the email will get to him. So if you want to contact him directly, you could. But if you have some questions that you'd like to ask, perhaps it might be better if you sent them to me. I will forward them to him and get the answer back to you. And that way I can share the question and the answer with everybody who joined the teleclass. Thank you again. This has been a wonderful time. I hope we can do it again. And thanks to Ecolab for their support of teleclass education and of this teleclass in particular. And to all of you, I am very grateful that you've joined us, and I'll look forward to talking with you again soon. Goodbye.